60 seconds and counting. We are go for Apollo 7 at this time.
Alright, welcome back everybody. Thank you for being here. Hope you had a good dinner. Thank you for joining us through the live stream as well. Great to have you here. So we're going to have a little Q&A session here in about 55 minutes or so, where you, the audience, will get a chance to ask some of your questions to the members that have been here speaking today, digitally Stephen Bassett, who joins us as well. But we're going to have a little bit of a roundtable discussion here first and kind of bounce around some of the ideas that we've been learning about today to get a little better an idea. But obviously, just for potential newcomers, Robert Morningstar, we have Michael Schratt, then we have Stephen Bassett, as I said, from the PRG, and then we have Mark McCandlish, and of course, Joseph Farrell as well. So one of the things I was thinking about anyway when I heard some of the presentations here today was about how do we connect some of the work that we've, you know, heard about and some of the things that we've been learning about. I think Michael's and Mark's work very much ties together and is definitely one part of it. Then we have Robert's work, which is very much about the basis and everything else on the moon that we heard about. And then we have the kind of historical aspect that Farrell went into, of course. So I wanted to ask if there's any way that we can start to kind of connect some of these points that we heard. And maybe we can begin with you, Joseph. The, you know, the network, Reinhardt, Galen, you know, we have the Richter and all these interesting characters that show up, right? Is there any way that we can determine if the fruits of their labor is something that led to the kind of work that we saw Michael and Mark present when it comes to some of these vehicles, you know, talking about the Snowbird, the Hudson Valley Boomerang, the TR-3B. Is there any way we can kind of connect some of this work?
I think if you remember Mark's presentation, he was talking about three different magnetic fields around a central core with plasma, which would be a nonlinear medium, with capacitors and then dielectrics out of crystal in his back engineering of the physics that he thinks is behind this. Well, if you look back at my attempt to kind of reverse engineer the Nazi Bell story with Richter and his plasma and things like that. One of the interesting things that I didn't mention in the talk was if you look at the company backing Richter, it's the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft in Germany. They're General Electric. And this is precisely the same company that, if you dig into the details of the Bell, is behind the Bell story. And if you know the principles of the Nazi Bell, Richter is rotating his plasma. He's subjecting it to a precessional frequency. He's subjecting it to electrical stress. And he's claiming he's getting a fusion reaction in his material that's interacting with the zero-point energy. So what do we have? We've got a nonlinear medium, we've got rotation, we've got electrical stress, we've got a precessional rotation, which would mean differential rotation, so you think of the sun again. You go back to the Bell, and what do you have? You've got a central shaft, you've got a plasma-inducing material, you're subjecting it to electrical stress. I happen to think in my reconstruction of the physics that I think may have been involved, you have counter-rotating both mechanical and electrical fields. You have the use of two potentials, AC and DC, and they're subjecting this to stress in a plasma-inducing medium. So basically, the concepts are almost identical with what he's talking about. And I think there's another clue here, perhaps in the work of Gabriel Krohn, who was, and again, I didn't talk about him in my presentation, but he was a Hungarian-American genius electrical engineer. I think he's almost as significant, probably as significant, as Nikola Tesla, and he's almost completely forgotten. And he did, in 1935, a paper on phase creep and other anomalies in large rotating networked electrical systems, and he concluded that the tensor calculus of Einstein's general relativity could be used to explain this phenomenon. And that's highly significant, because what he said is he's bringing tensor calculus out of the physics of the very large, and he's bringing it down to the laboratory bench. And he's saying in 1935, you can engineer this stuff locally on the laboratory bench. And of course, he ends up over here in this country. And most of his publicly written books on applying tensor calculus to electrical circuits, they're very difficult to get a hold of. I attempted to get a hold of one book in particular through interlibrary loan, and it was in a corporate library. I could rent it. I could not take it out of the library. I could not make photocopies, and they wanted $1,200, just the corporation that had this. So I've had to make do with picking and finding other books by Gabriel Cron. So I think he's a huge part of the story, and he ties directly to what he was talking about. And so I think, yes, there's a conceptual connection.
Right, because, you know, Ben Rich and Ed Fouché, some of the people you talked about, Michael, I mean, is there any evidence that what they built on is something that, you know, the work, the Farrell that he talked about, that they got it from somewhere like that? Is there a similarity between the sources for this, for the work that they used to build all these, you know, crafts with?
The only thing I would say to that regarding what Joseph had talked about is something we mentioned earlier this morning, where a number of British intelligence officials overran sections of Nazi Germany and started bringing up every scrap of evidence they could do on radar cross-section reduction, different stealth technologies. Sometime in the 1960s, that was put into something called the Dawson Report, and from that point forward, there's been this liaison between the USA and the UK regarding stealth aircraft programs. And so it's anyone's guess just how much they progress from this point forward.
Right. Mark, do you have anything to add to that in terms of the connections, you know?
Well, I have to take my hat off to Joseph Farrell. I think he's done some fantastic research. I am very impressed. Very impressed. Not just in the way that he tracks the financial things that have happened, where the money's gone, how it's been taken and so forth, but how it's been used to simulate and develop technologies that are being sequestered and taken and kept away from us. I don't really know that I can add anything other than the fact that I'm convinced that there are other technologies that are becoming more and more evident even as we speak. Even in last year, in fact, it was almost exactly a year ago at this time, on the 12th of July, I saw an immense cylindrical vehicle hovering near Palo Cedro, probably 15 to 17,000 feet, bigger than an aircraft carrier. And this thing was, it was about a little bit after 9 o'clock at night. The sun had already gone down, but this thing was high enough that the sun was still striking it. And this object, whatever it was using some kind of a visual stealth system that would make it look as though you were looking at the piece of sky that is beyond where the craft is, except that because of the cylindrical shape of the craft and its smooth surface, when it rotated in space, the sun was glinting off of that smooth surface, and when it came around to the point where the sort of a round hemisphere-shaped edge reflected the sun, there was a big flare. And almost immediately after pointing it out to another witness who was at the site, this thing took off like it had been fired out of a cannon. And I've seen a few things on the internet that there are actually some kind of uniforms that some of the special ops people can wear that seem to do the same thing. There are certain materials that are being developed that appear to be able to bend light. And I'm not exactly sure how they do that, but these are some of the other technologies that are coming to play. I've got one witness who lives in the community Moriarty, which is east of Kirtland Air Force Base, where there's alleged to be an awful lot of work on this kind of technology be done by Sandy Labs and other organizations, who said that one day while she was hiking near the perimeter of the military installation, that she saw a disc emerge from a cliffside as though the cliff had momentarily been almost like a hologram, and the vehicle emerged right out of the side of the cliff, and then the the sort of wavering image of the cliff reasserted itself, and off it went. And it was shortly after that that the base commander of the facility came out and showed an interest in the chicken farm, and they wanted to buy chickens for the base cafeteria, and isn't this nice? And so there was sort of this symbiotic relationship where if you don't talk about this stuff, you know, we'll buy your chickens. So it was, but it's a true story. And that's not the only thing. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier, either in a discussion with some of the people I was talking to or part of my presentation, that there have been a number of sightings where there were what appeared to be conventional aircraft that were using exotic technologies that would allow them to hover or move slowly in space without producing any jet noise at all. And this young lady happens to be one of those witnesses who saw this. And so at the moment, I'm trying to work with her or send her a number of photographs of different aircraft types to find out whether this is simply an F-35 prototype that's using noise cancellation technology or whether it's really some kind of mass cancellation technology that they're employing. But I haven't really figured out exactly what kind of aircraft type it was just yet. The one that I mentioned earlier where it was hovering around a water tower looked a lot like what was called the F-16XL. It was a modified version of the F-16 that had kind of a delta-shaped wing instead of a large wing and a small wing. But so that's about as much as I can say.
Right. Now, gentlemen, open-ended question. So what can we do to move from a place of, you know, speculation and knowing and eyewitnesses and all that stuff into getting closer to some kind of answer of what we actually are dealing with here? I mean, it's a fundamentally such a complex question, right, that is very difficult. But what is necessary, do you think? We can go through around the table if you guys want as well, to kind of get a little bit more certainty, get closer to some kind of answer about this question of what we're dealing with, what the, you know, is it a threat level? Is it something, you know, there's so many components to this, but it's kind of a little bit, what's the next step in the process here to open up this even further and making it even more known? Go ahead.
I was very gratified to see the quotation from the Sanskrit describing the Vimanas. Because I first read about Vimanas in 1968 as I was going through the Upanishads and the Mahabharata. And as I read it, I said, my God, this makes perfect sense. It's just that we don't know what they're talking about. We don't know the words for these elements that they're using to power their craft. Now, I think personally that the breakthrough has already happened, that what we have to do is break a monopoly on knowledge, that we have a problem in this country that we have a field of physics and we have a field of forbidden physics. And this boils down to the exclusion of the work of Faraday and Maxwell's equations in particular. There are four equations, systems, and that three you can play with, the fourth one you can't even talk about in public. So breaking the monopoly on the forbidden physics. But the hope that I have is that this monopoly has already been broken. And I base this on a statement made by a very well-known Hindu scientist in 2010 who made an announcement that India has made a tremendous breakthrough in technology. That this breakthrough in technology is going to change the whole world. But because of certain protocols that they have to observe with regard to the United Nations and the United States, an agreement has been made that they will not speak about it for several years. The understanding I had from his statement was that it would be between 2012 and 2014 when the world is ready. And the problem is that we have this raging locomotive, which is the basis of our modern technology, the oil, the coal, atomic energy, and that this thing has a tremendous momentum. It's a financial momentum. It's a political momentum, spheres of interest, and that this locomotive cannot just be stopped. And so it has to be slowly arrested, and the transition has to be slowly begun. Now, I like to tell this story because the Hindu scientist said this. He said, many years ago, when Indira Gandhi became the Prime Minister of India, she called together a council of the top scientists, and she said, we are the Hindu people. We are the Indian civilization. We are 5,000 years old. Western civilization looks down upon our history as mythology, as legend, but it is not so. I want you all to delve into the Mahabharata, the Upanishads, and I want you to extract from that the technology of the Vimanas. I want you to translate and find out what those elements are, and I want you to make Vimanas. And that's what he said they did, and that this breakthrough, which he did not name, that is coming, is already in the works, but because of United Nations protocols and their agreement to keep it quiet, we have to wait a bit longer. And so the monopoly has to be broken, not just to the knowledge in the United States, but other countries are joining together to break the monopoly that the United States, Britain, and their allies in the forbidden science have taken. So I have a hope for the future.
Looking through the 65 three-ring binders of the Leonard Stringfield collection at Lunkton Airport, there was some interesting correspondence between Leonard Stringfield and astronaut Gordon Cooper. And according to Gordon Cooper, the only way that this field could proceed forward, according to Gordon Cooper, was that if the scientific community overruled the intelligence communities and brought the information out to the general public. So it was in his impression that this is the only way that this would move forward.
Stephen, you've done a lot of work on this, of course. You're getting the word out, breaking this.
I think this is working.
Well, I think if the question is, what is the next step in getting to the truth of the matter on these issues, I think there's hardly anybody in this room doesn't know what my answer is. The next step, assuming another nation, major nation, doesn't take independent action, is to maneuver the U.S. government, which in this case really means the executive branch, the president and the Pentagon, into a position where they have to acknowledge and announce the extraterrestrial presence, which is disclosure. The disclosure event. That's all it is. It's not, you know, dumping 4,000 boxes of files or revealing how many condos and Corvettes the Nazis got when they came under paperclip. It just means that there's an ET presence. Now, you know, give us a few moments or a few days to think about what we want to say next. That's all it is. And it's a very simple thing. And because it's a simple thing, with the right moves on the chessboard, you can actually make it happen. And I happen to believe that it's ready to happen, and it can happen this year. And I talk a lot about that a lot. Meaning that the necessary moves to get the President of the United States to cut a deal with the Pentagon so that both sides are relatively happy with how it's going to be done will come in front of the American people and announce ET presence. Now, guess what? After that, all hell breaks loose, and a lot of stuff starts getting resolved very quickly. Now, before I comment further, I do want to make two quick mentions here. First of all, I have to say that based upon certainly what we've heard today and what I'm pretty sure we're going to hear tomorrow, I happen to think this is the most sophisticated conference presentation on this subject matter I have ever attended. And that includes my conferences. This is high, high level stuff. This is the kind of conference where you get to use all that education you went and got, because you really need it to cover this material. The second thing I want to say is that it's difficult to keep up with everything that's going on, and the people and the research in this field. It's vast. So I'm not up on everything. So I confess today that I have come late to the Joseph Farrell fan club. But boy, am I on board. Because this work is extraordinary work. And let me tell you why. You know, the problem with activism, which is essentially trying to get the government to change its policy, and most of you, like me, have lived through some of the most significant activist movements of the 20th century, both in the United States and abroad, so you know what it's like, is that you can't go to the media, you can't go to the people, you can't go to the politicians with a 67-year historical model of an event that will have 50,000 books written about it and say, you know, have you got 4 days? I want to give you the picture here. You have to create some basic fundamentals, get people involved, and then get a result. What are the fundamentals? There's an extraterrestrial presence. The United States government has withheld that acknowledgement. The United States government has ET technology, which has been absorbed into a massive secret world and research with huge amounts of money. And that secret world now contains a whole bunch of other stuff that you don't know about, from biowarfare work to everything else. The whole thing's floating away and getting away from us. And if we don't deal with it pretty soon and bring everything down, that's pretty much it. And we want the United States president to announce ET presence. That's pretty much it. But what happens there is that a lot of people think, okay, that's it. Oh, no, that's not it. Let's be clear. The truth embargo, which I casually refer to, was a massive program in which billions upon billions of dollars were spent, not only to keep the research secret, to keep the finances secret, and to keep the media under control, and the philanthropists out of the picture, and the universities pretty much out of the picture. A major 67-year effort that is unparalleled in history. And then the actual history of the phenomena and the ET presence, and of course all the scientific research, is vast. So we're sitting on this huge historical reality, which is not available in schools to learn about, and isn't going to be until the disclosure event takes place. So it's really kind of an odd situation. It's like there's this giant hole in the last 67 years of reality, and we're supposed to sort of not know about that, and then just sort of marvel at the things that are happening. We don't know why. Why did we suddenly end the moon program? Why is the shuttle program suddenly not there? And 100 other things. Oh, well, it's just the way it is. Oh, no, no. It's part of a large picture. Most of the picture just isn't available at your movie theater right now. And the last thing I'd like to say before I pass the mic is this. There was one critical moment in Joseph's presentation. Well, there were many critical moments, but there was one in particular that I noted. It came toward the end. And essentially the particular meme that he presented was that one of the very possible reasons why the secrecy has been so profoundly maintained is that the power of the energy systems and technology that's being worked on, as well as the anti-gravitic technology, if it gets in the wrong hands, could be a serious problem. I'd like to mention something to you may have forgotten about. Back in 1991, 92, actually slightly before 91, there were articles which I read, because I was in Washington at the time, that the military was kind of had a problem in that they had been developing a huge range of very sophisticated weapons and were very frustrated that there wasn't a war that they could use them in. There just hadn't been one for a while. And interestingly enough, about the same time I was reading this article, April Glaspie, whatever his name is, one of the ambassadors, one of the, diplomats working with Bush, Glaspie, turns up in Saddam Hussein's office and gives him a little wink nod about, you want to go in Kuwait? It's like, we don't care. And the next thing, he goes into Kuwait, and the next thing you know, we're at war. But nothing like I'd ever seen before. We were at war. And so we're getting the feedback from the war, and of course we're killing lots of people, but that was really wasn't the key thing. What was, we were getting day after day after day of some generals, usually Schwarzkopf or some colonels, saying, here's today's footage. Here is this gun, the nose camera footage from a guided missile launched by a stealth plane 400 miles away. Here it comes in. Here's the bridge that's going to blow up. Oh, there's a bicycle going across. Boom, blows up the bridge, or the house, or the car. And they're just having a hell of a time showing off the incredibly sophisticated weapons, stealth, camera technology, guidance, all this stuff. In other words, they had a chance to really use those weapons, and it was on some Iraqis who had stepped over the line, and you gotta, break a few eggs. And it finally got so bad that they stopped it, because they were getting a lot of negative feedback from Americans are going, you're just showing off just a touch too much here. Right? I mean, these are dead people at the end of these weapons. So the point I want to make is this. Joseph Farrell made a key point that maybe the secrecy is because these weapons, if they get in the wrong hands, could be dangerous. I would like to make the suggestion that they are already in the wrong hands.
I have no argument. No argument. Thank you for that, by the way. I just want to add something to what Robert said, and I think Mark has suggested this as well, and now you, that maybe the specific method that might be adopted to start bringing pressure, not only on the government, but in the wider community, is to show that there is a hidden physics, just like you suggested. There's, and I call it public consumption physics versus hidden physics. You called it secret physics, yeah. I think we need a history of all of the indications of that secret physics, number one. I think that's what we need. And number two, we need to show people in that history that this is dangerous stuff. This is very, very dangerous stuff. Like you said, it would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So people need to understand that. But I think once they understand that, they're going to be able to see that behind all of these financial shenanigans and the non-responsiveness of the government and bankers that want no bailout oversight and so on, that this might be a possibility. I think that's one kind of indirect approach. I know it's not quite as direct as direct pressure on the government, but I think the indirect approach, educating people, is crucial to this. We need enough inertia to make that pressure work.
Oh, all right. Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start, but what I'd like to say is that I do know a number of scientists who are familiar with this technology and are very excited about the possibility of doing some work, shall we say, in this area. People who would like to experiment with things like the devices that I showed up on the screen. And one of the things that I find universally true in almost every single case of these individuals is that almost every one of them have had close encounters of one kind or another since childhood, are very comfortable with it. And aside from that, I have to say that I've also seen a fair amount of evidence that time travel really is possible and that these entities, whoever they are looking back across time and they're seeing individuals that at some point in the future have historical significance in bringing this technology forward. Now, I know some of those individuals, and I know that they are eminently qualified to work in this area. And the big problem, of course, is funding, because most of the time the funding is going to come from a company that already knows about this stuff and doesn't want it to come out because they've got the market cornered. So what really needs to happen is that there needs to be private investment. There need to be people, individuals, organizations, groups that come together privately for trying to develop the technology and do it in such a way that it isn't a threat, that it doesn't get out, that the cat doesn't get out of the bag and wind up in the hands of some Sunni terrorists or something. But the other thing I want to say is that I think having worked in the defense industry for many years as a designer and a conceptual artist, that I've had an occasion to study all the different byproducts of war, what it does to people, what it does to the landscape, the environment, what it does to the mindset of people, whether it's a nation that feels that they deserve vengeance for an act that occurred on their soil, whether or not another group feels that they have to get revenge for a country coming in and trying to take their resources. Whatever it is, it all boils down to a kind of fear. A fear that someone's going to take my stuff or take my land or take my life. And people don't deserve to live like that. We're far too intelligent. We've got too much potential. And I think that the powers that be are really working overtime to sort of dumb us down and make us ignore this sort of fundamental truth that we all have this great potential. We have the ability to use these things, use them wisely, use them in a way that's beneficial to the environment and to the planet. And so what we really need to do is put together some people that are willing to invest the time and the money and do so in a private way that's away from that corporate and that government control mechanism. something that will, and that's part of the reason why I've come out and I've talked about this stuff year over year. I paid dearly for the disclosures that I've made. My career is gone. It's basically, I don't have any clients anymore. I sift kitty litter all day at an animal rescue facility. So, and I'm not kidding. It's true. I mean, one by one, my clients basically dropped off the map. People don't like me to say that because it makes it sound like, oh, geez, if you come forward as a witness, you're going to pay a price. Well, believe me, you will. And the reason that I came forward is because the information that I had was so astounding, so monumental in terms of human history and what its implications are. I felt that we all deserve to know. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, in the beginning, and I feel tremendous regret about this, that there were people who encouraged me to name names and dates and places and things like that. And there were other people who I think also paid a price because I didn't know any better. I wasn't a journalist. I didn't know about, you know, maintaining confidences and all that kind of thing. And so I feel terrible about that because it has cost other people their livelihood and their employment and things like that. And I regret that. I sincerely regret that. But I think it's more important that we save the planet from where it's going right now. And so that's the bottom line.
I wanted to return to the Brookings Institution paper, the white paper on the peaceful uses of outer space. I didn't really flesh it out. One was the religion part. The other great concern that they had was the destabilization of science. And the statement they made was that if we should encounter intelligent life on the moon, intelligent life in the outer space, and an intelligence that was so far ahead of us in this kind of technology, that it would be so distressing to scientists, doctors, and engineers that they might become so depressed that they might not even get up out of bed to go to work the next day because of the futility in their minds of having to catch up with a civilization that was 200 and 300 years ahead of us. So there are gatekeepers to science. And this is a monopoly that has to be broken. Let me tell you about something that happened to me in 2010. On October 13th, 2010, there was a massive UFO flyby and fly around New York City. Hundreds of UFOs were seen by thousands of people. You can go to YouTube and find it. CBS was filming people. Hundreds of people on 8th Avenue looking at spherical UFOs going around New York. On the following day, I was invited to a UN reception to award the Leonov Medal to the United Nations Ambassador for Outer Space Affairs, Maslan Othman. And present as well were dignitaries from the Department of State and dignitaries, another dignitary from the United Nations, Mr. Propriatu, who is the chairman of the UN Committee for the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. He was a Romanian cosmonaut who flew in space. And we hit it off very well. He was very affable and receptive, and I introduced myself as editor of UFO Digest, and he lit up. You know, he liked the idea. So then they had a panel like this, and they wanted questions. So I raised my hands and directed my question to Mr. Propriatu, and I asked him what plans the United Nations had for the contingency of encountering intelligent life in outer space. And he lit up. He beamed. I had thrown him the pitch for a home run. You know, it looked like that to me. He smiled. He got ready. And he said to me, to the audience, the United Nations has many plans, many contingency plans, not just for encountering intelligent life in outer space, but even finding microbial life in outer space. And these plans, I'll stop there, because at the other end of the table, I saw some shoulders go up like this. I had introduced myself to Madam Othman, and I saw some shoulders go, excuse me, I want to say something. She cut him off. Very un-United Nations. I want to say something. Nothing on this issue is ever going to come to the floor of the United Nations unless it is sponsored by one of three bodies. It has to be presented formally to the United Nations General Assembly by one of three scientific bodies: the International Association of Astronautics, the International Association of Aeronautics, and the International Association of Science. If one of these three bodies does not sponsor a motion to take this up in the General Assembly, this will never reach the floor of the United Nations. And there was our answer. We have gatekeepers in science, the priesthood of science, a science that has established man as God and cannot accept a spiritual reality. And folks, we are dealing with something that we would have to call a spiritual reality. If we're talking about interdimensional travel, time travel, faster than the speed of light travel, we are talking about an alternate reality. I see modern scientists as prisoners. Buckminster Fuller invented a molecule called a carcerand that traps another molecule inside. Well, I see scientists as inhabiting a carcerand. They're entrapped by their own system of beliefs, and they do not want to change those beliefs because their status, their economics, their livelihood is based on that. And the day that gone, we're all equal. Okay? Thank you.
Yeah, you really touched on a very significant point. And it has one of the deleterious effects of this 67-year process we've been through is enormous impact on science. Let's be clear. The scientific method, in my view, is the greatest intellectual accomplishment of the human race since it emerged from its arboreal beginnings. It's an incredible thing. And the people that pursue science are doing extraordinary things. When you build a rocket to go to the moon, it can't be built on hunches, guesses, prayers, or anything other than the hardest of science, or it won't work. It won't even get 1 millimeter off the ground. And this is true about a lot of things we do. Okay, so what's the situation on science on this issue? Well, first of all, about 20 years ago, this is 20 years ago, a poll was done of just scientists on their view with respect to the phenomena. It's similar to many of the polls that have been done with the general public. 50% of the American people consistently poll this phenomenon as extraterrestrial. Okay. Well, a poll was done of just scientists, and guess what? 50% of the scientists polled said this is extraterrestrial. Okay. That's interesting. All scientists, they weren't just doing astronomers, all scientists, biologists, archaeologists, whatever. 50%. Okay, great. It gets more interesting. The best statistics that I have seen on the conservative side, and this is something I'm going to be talking about soon and I'm about to publish something of interest, 2% of the American people are contactees, physical contactees. It's a big number. It's about 7 million, which means that 2% of the scientists are contactees. You just alluded to that. Okay. So we got 2% of the scientists are contactees. That's a big number. And you've got 50% believe it's extraterrestrial. So we must have a significant scientific engagement of the issue. Peer review papers, institutions, all of that. No, we don't have any of that. We have the odd scientist that has stepped out, right? We know some of them. John Mack was a scientist, psychiatrist. He stepped out. Harvard tried to sack him. Cost him $250,000. And a few others like that. But that's it. And all the scientists working at the universities who are teaching and doing a little research, how many fully accredited programs on the phenomenon exist in the 5,000 colleges and universities? Zero. Okay. And so where's the research being done on the energy? Well, the research on the energy issue is primarily being done by non-college-trained garage inventors, okay, who are very smart, with the odd, you know, BS in physics, you know, sprinkled in there. And they're cruising along, and again, the physics is there, right? And one of the reasons it's there is that people have been seeing these things flying around for the last 60 years, and it's just like you see the birds fly, you come up with an aerodynamic wing. You see an anti-gravity craft coming, you start looking for the reasons for that. That's what humans do. They're very good at it. And so you got all these inventors, and they all keep coming up with little things. Well, guess what happens there? This is the citizen science situation. They file for a patent. The patent gets eminent domain. They file for a patent. It's not accepted, right? Their lab gets closed down. They get closed down, right? All kinds of suppressions all over the board, some of which get to the level of what they call executive action. So being an inventor in this, not easy. So you have a massive scientific suppression that covers the entire scientific community, college level. You've got, you know, citizen scientists being, wow, in the name of what? Right? In the name of maintaining the truth embargo. And so when you corrupt science at that level, guess what? It spreads. If you're a scientist with noble intentions, worked like hell to get that PhD, went through the whole rigmarole, I could have gotten one, but I would have had a nervous breakdown. And you get appraised of this. You know this is going on, and most of them do. Basically, you're compromised. You're in, right? You've just signed up. And so you know that's going on, and so now you are vulnerable to every other manner of corruption that the government wants to do. Now, this happened in the Soviet Union. It happened in Nazi Germany, but it's not supposed to happen here, but it is. And so in the climate area, you've got corruption, you've got violations of all kinds of principles, you've got a breakdown in the system. And so essentially, we have lost a significant percentage of scientific advances since 1947 because a blanket was put over the whole shebang and said, look, you can do your science, but it's underneath the blanket. And that's a tragedy. And one of the costs of the truth embargo.
Well, the question is that done because this is something that they want to keep to themselves, right? This is something that has been achieved at some point, and now they have to try to keep the lid on in some way. Kind of what Joseph talked about a little bit as well, that what if this was developed long time ago, and now in the direction where some science approaching today is becoming a little bit too close to that, so it's very important for them to kind of try to keep the lid on. Sure, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think I'm going to be talking a little bit about this tomorrow. I think that inevitably when you approach certain ancient texts, and I'm glad that you mentioned that story about Indira Gandhi. I want to talk to you about that. But it's going to be inevitable that this group of people in this breakaway group, secret space program, whatever you want to call it, they're going to be forced to go back and look at ancient texts and compare them with what they're doing. And that's going to be a cloak of secrecy. So this culture of corruption begins to spread. This is what disturbs me. It begins to spread from the physics and engineering into biology, into archaeology. It begins to infect virtually everything so that the education system itself simply becomes a mechanism, and I really truly believe that this is true to a certain extent, becomes a mechanism for maintaining the secrecy. It's the biggest gatekeeper in our country, and for that matter, it's the biggest gatekeeper in the West. And the illustration of this is, I don't want to mention certain big name scientists, but they write their popular physics books, and at the end of their popular physics books, they give you a footnote, and they refer you to the back and give you Maxwell's equations. And they're not Maxwell's equations. They're Oliver Heaviside's edits of Maxwell's equations. So there's some of your suppression right there, and then that's taught to the physics students, you see. So we really need, you know, I'm in full agreement with Robert and with Stephen. We need to open up the physics and be aware of this pervasive culture of corruption. We have to start with ourselves. I hope that answered your question to some extent.
Can't that be can't that be done? And this can be to anybody without kind of trying to enter into the official world. Kind of what you talked about, Mark, that this is in the field of the private, you know, privateers. That this is something with the knowledge that exists that we can be outside of the realm that is very much controlled, right?
Well, I know that there have been private efforts before. I believe there was an effort that was sponsored by Joe Fermage. Yeah. And I know one of the scientists who was involved in that. And there are gatekeepers. There's very clearly gatekeepers, high-ranking scientists who are very well established, who sort of follow the same sort of outlook or thinking that Stephen had described. He was hitting all the notes, described it to a T, exactly the way it is. And the biggest problem with private enterprise is that these investors like to see results very quickly for their millions of dollars that they invest. They want to see something flying within 5 or 6 months. They don't want to wait 5 years. They don't want to wait 10 years. They want it now. And sometimes if you're going to do the science right and do it safely and do it in a way that's not harmful to human beings and the environment, you have to jump through all the hoops and make sure that it is safe. And it takes time. It has to be done right. All the T's have to be crossed. All the equations have to be completed properly. And so it takes patience. It takes someone with the faith to know that it'll eventually produce fruit that's beneficial. But the problem is that many of the gatekeepers that help to vet whether or not the funding will be allowed are people that come from that particular mindset that don't want the information coming out because they really know how dangerous it is. And they also know that it'll have a dramatic effect on the economy in terms of the production of fossil fuels, energy production, automobiles. Anything that depends on fossil fuels for its operation will be affected by this kind of technology. And so, personally, I think that the way that you do the workaround on that is that you point out to them that petrochemicals are so much more valuable when they're turned into pharmaceuticals or plastics or synthetics than if you just burn them in the engine of your car. And I would be willing to just bet that there's some chemist out there somewhere who's figured out a way to turn coal into gasoline. But they just are suppressing that like everything else because there's so much of it sitting out there in reserve. It's like money in the bank. They don't have to touch it until sometime when all the rest of the petroleum in the world's been used up. All the most difficult sweet crude in the world to dig up out of the ground has been used up. And now, finally, after all this time, America has some of the biggest coal reserves in the world. And so we've got the market cornered and they're stuck. So I think that it's the kind of thing where people have to really be dedicated, devoted to the idea that we can do something new and better. And that it won't necessarily, I think it was Robert who said that there has to be a transitional period where you work through the change so that it doesn't have this negative impact on the economies of the world, on the way people get their jobs, and where they work, what they work on, what they're producing. Because if you can do that, if you can make that transition gracefully and slowly, then you can bring about some big changes that will be beneficial to everybody and the environment. So.
But that's kind of like a bottleneck, though, really. I mean, anything that we've developed in the past have been done in fewer hands first, and then it goes outwardly, right? Even, you know, think about the printing press or even the internet. It was developed by DARPA, you know, ARPANET, and then eventually that became, I don't know, democratized, if that's the right word, commercialized or available to people, you know? So same has to occur within this field to a certain degree, right? I mean, there might even be people who have already achieved some of this, and they have the knowledge, and they've gone before us, right? But can this be opened up and made available to more people?
Well, that's a wonderful analogy. ARPANET, they voluntarily let it out into the public. Now, there's a lot of politicians, old fogey politicians, that regret that now. Because most of the politicians were of a age and a generation. They had no idea what the internet was, didn't know how to use an email, and that thing just got out the door. The government let it out the door, and now it has come back around to basically bite them in the ass, big time. The internet is the number one threat to centralized, controlled, corrupt government. And, you know, it will help bring all this down. But the situation with ET technology, or whether it's ET derived or human derived, is unique, because essentially the situation is this: the government has created an embargo on the ET reality. Let's forget about the tech, just the ET reality. That cannot be acknowledged. Anything that threatens that embargo, theoretically up until today, must not be allowed. And so, yeah, like they let the internet out, they could let anti-gravity out. They just come to us one day, the president go in front of us and say, guess what? The National Science Foundation has just informed me that we have gravitic craft. And we've been working on it, and they're going to become available. We're going to bring that technology out. Just think of the wonderful things. They're not going to do that. Because the next day, they're going to get 5 million questions on the internet. Where did you get anti-gravitic technology? We want the complete providence. We want to know the scientists that worked on it. They want their papers, their notes, how they figured it out. We want the whole history of it. And the government knows they can't give you that history because the history has an ET connection, and therefore it will be denied you.
Well, they're good about making up stories, right? So they could make something
up. Yeah, but the American people are getting better at putting holes in their stories, right? It's getting harder to lie. This is a major problem for American politics. The internet is making it harder to lie. Not surprisingly, the government's response to this dilemma was to attend courses on how to lie better. Right? We're going to outwit the internet. And so what you have is you have all of these things being held hostage to a fundamental issue. We are not prepared to announce the ET presence. It's not we're not prepared to announce a great technology breakthrough. No, we can't announce it because we're not prepared to announce the ET presence. And so when people like certainly Richard Dolan, one of the most important people in this field, period, write what they write, what you start to learn is the cost of all this, right? The cost of all this. Let's respond to something that was just said. This economic transition, if we bring out zero-point energy, which may be partially derived from ET technology of some sort, well, a lot of jobs are going to be lost because we may be closing gas stations in 10 years or whatever. I will stand that completely on its head. If you could, in a reasonable length of time, say within 2 years after disclosure, start installing major energy generators working off of zero point, producing electricity initially on a high level, factories, cities, and everything else, at 1 cent on the dollar, meaning your electrons are coming for 1 cent instead of a buck, the impact on the economy would be astronomical because you would have lowered the cost of business in a huge range of areas. Most importantly, you would lower the cost of development projects in business, whereas you've got 1,000 business plans that won't work. Drop the energy price by 95%, they all work. Suddenly, millions of people are being put back to work doing things they can now afford to do. Disclosure is not an impact, negative impact in the economy. It is the answer to our economic development. And so by withholding this technology under the truth embargo, they are putting millions of people out of work. They're creating economic crises that are taking your home, your pension, your job, and it's all in the interest of national security. And if the Harvard University or MIT wants to send out some of their fine professors to debate the impact of disclosure to the American people with me, I would be happy to do it. And maybe they can make the case, oh, no. Super cost, low technology, terrible thing. Oh, energy gets that cheap, all terrible things will happen. People will drive too much, they'll use up too much, like whatever the hell. Let them do it, but they won't do it. And you have never seen it because they can't do it. They cannot win that argument. They can't even begin to win that argument. And so they say nothing. Nothing at all. And we raise these issues on the net, in conferences. I've raised it on CNN, Fox. We've got books out there. They have nothing to say about it because they cannot talk about it. Because if they do, it will hurt their career. You want to know how the America got from being the greatest nation on earth with the most powerful economy and everything else in 1950 to a nation that's on its way out the door with collapsing infrastructure, mass corruption, and $17 trillion in debt, and $200 million in unfunded liabilities. You look at those kinds of actions. You look at that history, and that's exactly the result you're going to get when you can, when you follow those policies.
All right, very good. Let's, that's all right. Let's get to some questions here, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? For those of you who have them, let's line up at the mic there, right?
If somebody has a question, line up here.
Yeah. And as I said before, just to remind you guys as well, try to keep it as short as you can, you know, on point, so we can squeeze as many as possible in there, so we don't get too much good stuff going on there. Yeah, that's right. Ed Grimsley. Yeah, you're going to have a little event happening a little bit later there. Yeah. All right, just a couple of moments here, and then we'll get to the questions. There we go. So tell us, what do you have in store for us?
Thank you. Everybody here okay? I'm what's left of Ed Grimsley. These are night vision goggles. And what I discovered kind of made me famous around the world about night vision goggles and what you can see with them. And that the UFOs are real. They're active, but birds and bats and satellites are too. And there's a lot of debunkers out there saying Ed Grimsley's in that. I agree. I'm crazy, but not as much as being too stupid. I'd rather be a little crazy than too stupid. And I want to tell you real quick, tonight, there's a motorhome out here. It's a Toyota, white, with a Ford body, and I'm going to be out there with a lot of night vision goggles. And you people are invited to come out. There's a lot of money sitting there, and I don't want you to walk away with them, so we're going to have some F-16s fly by. And if you leave with them, we're going to bomb you. Now, the other thing being that you cannot, with these on, you can't look out into the darkness and then take your head away and look over there and turn it towards the light, because it's still affected. You might not see it. So you got to be careful about pointing them at a light. You have to also be careful taking flashbulb pictures, lighting a cigarette, smoking, or dropping them, because they're about $3,000 a pair, and I get them for $2,500 and have them specially made. If you want some, fine. But please come out, see, and be aware what's up there so that you know a little of what I know, and what these people are talking about is a lot of truth. And there's a lot more going on than you can see. So I got to make this quick. Do not leave the area where we're at. Stay in one area with the goggles. And in turn, we'll have a good time and try to share with each other and respect that I'm going to have about $35,000 worth of goggles out there for you to use free. Now, Kevin Smith had a radio show, and Dr. Roger Lear, and they were both good friends with me, and anything you folks want to donate will be split for their two families. So thank you very much.
Does everyone know where you're going to be? Remind us where you're going to be again. Remind us where you're going to be again, so people know where to go after we're done here, if they want to join you.
Oh, I'm not getting old and forgetful, but it's going to be out in the parking lot near my motorhome. It's a Toyota, and if you go out the gate just down to the left, it'll be there about 150 feet. You can gather. I could probably show you real quick if I have a moment enough, but used as a cup, and there's an adjustment here, and there's one on each eyepiece here and here, and if your eyes don't see it very well, I think I gotta go now.
We'll catch that later then. Thanks.
My mommy told me there'd be days like this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ed.
Okay.
It's appreciated. Okay, let's get on with the Q&A.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Bob Oliver, and I know Andrew. So what Ed was trying to explain to you is that the night vision goggles represent $4,000, and if you shine them a light, they're ruined.
Yeah.
So do not point at a light, a car headlight, or airplane light, that will ruin it. $4,000 goggles to have two. Gentlemen, the way I see it is we have a lot of social problems as a result of what we're experiencing and talking about. In our own communities, we have police that are framing people right and left. We have a court system that will now not allow you to represent yourself. You are deemed a psychiatric threat to the court, therefore they want to put you on medication before they want you to tell your story. We have a prison system with 6 million Americans in it, of which that's 5 million more than any other country with the population that we have. And what I see simply, it's not a truth embargo anymore, because one out of three people have seen a UFO. It is now an energy embargo. They are not letting us have free energy. Thank you.
Jim Glenn, thinking of that statement I made earlier about how we can actually make this go, we've all been talking about that. I thought, we're sitting in Silicon Valley, full of people with money to burn, and we're in this age of disruptive technology. Like that's the new buzzword. There's lots of people with lots of money who could easily create a program like this and not even care about profit. We have Tesla, who's given away their patents recently. We got SpaceX. What do you think the odds are? Or perhaps more accurately, what do you think the startup cost of such a program would be?
What the specific program?
Do you want to direct that to somebody specific? Anybody? Want to pick up on that?
Specifically, when it feels so small.
What program? Define the program that you're saying you want to fund.
An anti-graphics program.
Ah.
A basic anti-graphics
program. Look, here's the problem. The government has a massive anti-graphics program. Okay. In fact, this is something I'll mention. Look. Here's another dilemma. You see, you have all of these inventors that are working on some of these technologies. You have people trying to raise money for them. Stephen Greer has been chasing them for years. And that's fine. But the problem is, the government is already way past that. And so the moment the government, you know, is prepared to step past the embargo and disclose, that technology becomes available, all of these other citizen techs are essentially worthless. Now, somebody will say, yeah, but the truth embargo could go another 20 or 30 years, so let's go ahead and do our own thing. Well, guess what? When you try to do your own thing, you get intervened. And having dealt, you know, look, if there are any money to burn, people in Silicon Valley want to sit down with me to have a little chat about how we can resolve this issue, I will take that meeting in a heartbeat. I've been based a lot out of L.A., trying to get to some Hollywood people. There's B actresses and actors down there that could fund a program like this. But it ain't happening. Why isn't it happening? Why hasn't Steven Spielberg come forward on this issue? Or any number of other people? I'll tell you why. Because the more money you make, the more powerful you are, the more family you have, the more you have to lose, And the government can make a simple call in the middle of the night from an agency and basically say, Mr. Spielberg, you've got it made. Make more movies, but if you publicly come forward and say ETs are here, we're going to make your life difficult. And what are you going to say if you're Spielberg? See, Steven Spielberg. Hey, I'll make movies. That's my contribution. That's enough. So who are the people that drive this issue? The people that lost their jobs already. The people that don't have diddly squat. And trust me, I don't have diddly squat. Who have nothing to lose. Well, okay, great. You say, fine, you're doing it. But, you know, when you're in that position, you have limits. And so the government has created this massive gap between the people with power and money who could end this embargo tomorrow and the people that are able to do this work. It's like a capacitor plate. And the job of the activist is to connect the top plate and the bottom plate and get a discharge. And that discharge is, in fact, the success of the advocacy movement, whether it's the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement or the right to vote movement for women, gay rights movement, the independence India movement from colonialism. You finally connect the charge between those two plates where the powers that be have separated the activists from the resources. And when those things collapse, it's over and you get what you want. And that's the dilemma. And so what I have seen in the last few years, I mean, PRG recently got $1 million. Now, it came from a Canadian, right? They feel a little safer up there, all right? A little less concerned about the CIA calling them up. But, you know, after 18 years, the money finally came from a Canadian and not an American. Okay, so we're $1 million down on that particular score, so I'm waiting for the $1 million American to come in. But still, I have seen enough people and dealt with enough people to know that it is... There is a huge barrier for the people with funds in this country to step into this particular issue. And I'll drive that point home. Probably more money is spent in 1 year on saving whales. And I love whales. More money is spent on saving the lives of whales in this world than 10 times all the money spent in this field, activists and research, since 1947. It's $30 to some $40 million a year is being spent on anti-whaling. Whaling is okay. This issue is verboten. So you see the problem, right? But there are people out there that are starting to cross the line. They're starting to go, I can do this. I can back this. I'm not afraid anymore. And that's one of the reasons why I think disclosure may be very close, because I do think they're going to come forward. And if they do, some of them may want to fund private anti-gravitic research. And that's a noble thing. But I would say to them, before you put millions of dollars into a citizen anti-gravitic research program, why don't we end the truth embargo and find out first what the government has so your money will not go to waste?
All right, thank you. Next question.
Henrik? Henrik?
Well, thank you, gentlemen. My name is Deborah Tavares, and I will stop the crying loud now. My interpretation of space maybe is a little bit more expansive than space. I look at it as our space in front of us right now, and I'm looking at the United Nations policies that are knocking on all our space doors right now. And I'm looking at frequencies that are causing mind control. I'm looking at poisoning of the water, the air, the food supply, and I am looking at Star Wars technology that is set up for mind control. So I really have to question everybody, are you sure you have free will? And are you sure your thoughts are your own? Because we've got AI now tracking, monitoring, and poisoning them. And on StopTheCrime.net, we have a NASA war document that our research team found. It legalizes all aspects of weaponization. It legalizes microdust sprayed into your lung tissue to commit certain pathological missions. It legalizes acoustic weapons, chemicals and biologicals, unmanned vehicles, viruses sprayed, poisoning the food, water, air supply, and so it will kill anything that moves anywhere, any place. And the only concern here is a self-replication and uncontrollable replication of nanotechnology. Now, there are many people wandering around now in increasing numbers that are targeted individuals from frequencies, and they're being absolutely decimated. by a technology with silent weapon system that is killing and taking us over. And I heard you talk about the need to have education. And I absolutely agree. We have to connect the dots, but I think we have to connect it first on a fundamental level, where sadly so many poisoned and toxic people can't even understand where where attention spans are 5 minutes max, where the education system is so dumbed down that people aren't able to add 2 and 2 because under Common Core curriculum that now equals 5.
Do you have a question?
I do. I'm getting to it. Thank you very much. I'm trying to paint the picture first because I was listening to you painting the picture. And so,
yeah, but we want quicker questions as well. Please get to the question.
I will. So my concern is what I'm not hearing, and what I haven't heard yet is our reality with Senate Report 93549, which is the explanation of how our system actually works. And until we understand that we have a de facto government that's run through the executive branch via executive order, until we recognize our reality, all the other realities, like ET and everything else, are not going to drive home with people because people are out of work, our jobs are being sent overseas, and we're getting very sick. So how would you address all of those topics? Thank you.
Yeah. Address all the topics right now.
Madam, I'd like to thank you.
This way?
Yeah.
It's working.
Okay. All right. Madam, I'd like to thank you for your question and your colloquy. You have asked a very important question, and that question is, are your thoughts really your own? And I ask people every day to try to think a thought that you have never thought before. That's a very challenging thing to engage in. Try to think a thought you've never thought before, because most of the thoughts in people's heads are not their own. They are being implanted by media, mass media, memes, and photographs. The issue of corruption. I'd like to hit three things right now. You talked about corruption. The gentleman came up to you, to the mic, about corruption, police framing people. This is happening all over the country. My friends, our nation is under attack, has been under attack for years and years and years, but we have not been able to recognize it because it is subversive. We do not have a vocabulary for what has been happening, but I see clearly those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it, and I have studied history and I see the pattern here. So I have had to coin two terms to express what is happening in America and the world today. One term is population pruning. The other term is slow genocide. Our country is being killed slowly. Somebody on this planet hates America more than any other country on earth. And this power is not a national power. This is an association of evil interests that see America as the final impediment to their whole, the complete takeover of the world and their philosophy, which is evil. And it has to be labeled. People, one of the problems I have with Einstein, that I said we have to reject Einstein and relativity, is that that little insight that he had has been hijacked, and a concept of moral relativity was imposed on us. And there is good and there is evil, and it is not relative. Here's the fallacy. Relativity theory applies to the relativity of physical objects, physical energy. When you're talking about the moral sphere, about ethics, that is not a physical thing. It is not science, it's ethics, and you cannot argue the principle of a moral relativity. Man has a conscience. Humans know, and I say humans, have a conscience, God-given, but that conscience is being perverted by indoctrination and, as you say rightly, mind control. Folks, I came here to change your consciousness. A breakaway civilization requires a breakaway consciousness. Stephen addressed the corruption of science. Science was not always corrupt.
Science has always been secret of necessity, but science in our nation was corrupted in 1 year, and that followed the assassination of President Kennedy. The Warren Commission report is the most evil thing that ever happened to this country. It was a reversal of the principles of science to force true a fake theory. It was a reversal of the principles of law, a reversal of the weight and value given to eyewitness testimony. All of it started there. In the years that followed, those who would not conform, those men and women of ethics and morals in the government, were weeded out, and a bunch of yes men and yes women who would comply with the corrupt policies of lying as a way of life have taken over. And it is that corruption that has to be extirpated from our society. And it is you who have to do it by recognizing the corrupt politician from the uncorrupted politician. Thank you.
Next question. Do you want to just add something quickly, Mark?
Yeah,
quickly.
I'd like to
say a few things.
Just quickly.
I was hoping to answer Jim Gladman's question about how much would it take to build or start something. And I'd like to address some of her remarks about poisoning the atmosphere and so forth with nanoparticles. First and foremost, as I pointed out in the discussion earlier about the alien reproduction vehicle and that anti-gravity technology, because there are different sizes available or evident, it's also clear that the technology is scalable. And by that I mean that you could probably build one that would fit on your desktop if you just knew what the basic principles of operation were, what the materials were, and that sort of thing. So I think that in terms of the funding requirements, those are scalable too. You could start out with somewhere between $10,000 and $100,000, and if you get some results with something small, then you could go up to something bigger, something that you could put a puppy dog in or a person. But you have to start small and build up so that you can establish a proof of concept. Now, as far as what this lady down here in the row, front row, was saying about poisoning the atmosphere and so forth, I live up in Redding, California, and we see this all the time. And not only is it being used to modify the weather, but I think it's harming the environment. I'll give you a couple examples. The aluminum oxide nanoparticles that they put into the atmosphere and the barium that they use, these are two of the components that you find in thermate explosives. And so when this material eventually filters down into the environment, there's a fire, or when there is a fire, you see fires that are very difficult to put out, especially in the forests. Now, the other side of this is that aluminum oxide is a conductor, and so when you have lots and lots of these nanoparticles in the atmosphere, it raises the electrostatic conductivity or electrostatic nature of the atmosphere, so you get more lightning strikes, so you get more fires. Some of the fires we've had in Northern California in the last 4 years have been immediately after heavy chemtrailing campaigns. Now, one of the things that bothered me about this incident with the bombing in Boston during the marathon was that the conservatives out there didn't want anybody picking up this copy of Rolling Stone because they were glorifying one of the Tsarnaev brothers on the cover like a rock star. But what that same issue of the magazine talked about was how all of the soot that's created by these forest fires is drifting up into the northern hemisphere and is covering the polar ice caps and lowering the albedo so that it's melting much more quickly. So this is something that a lot of people didn't get in touch with, didn't read, didn't see, because someone out there said, oh, you don't want to glorify that guy and make him a rock star. There was more content, more important things in that magazine besides a terrorist. So it is happening. Now, medically speaking, aluminum oxide suppresses the white blood cells in the alveoli, the little air sacs in your lungs. This is the front line of defense against respiratory infection. It also affects the ability of the mitochondria in your cells to help repair damage done to the genetic material in the nucleus of your cells. Barium salts, which are also in this chemtrail spray, also precipitates a condition known as pulmonary fibrosis. It's like scar tissue in your lungs.
Mark, can I interject?
I'm sorry.
I want to give all people
With the glare of the light, I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's try to speed it up here a little bit if we can.
Next
Thank
one.
you.
Yeah, so Bitcoin and relative cryptocurrency have shown us that the human race can hypothecate as much money as we need. Unfortunately, Bitcoin is not a great construction itself, and so we've shown us the light. So I kind of have a thought or a question for everybody, which is, how long should we wait for the existing system to reform itself, or how long should we just create a new reality?
Can I interject? Joseph, can you address the Bitcoin?
I don't know anything about it, to be quite honest, so I'm sorry.
Does anyone have a comment on Bitcoin?
This partially will respond to the nice lady that laid out some important points. One of the dilemmas we have now in trying to, quote, address the ills is that the after 67 years of abuse of power and other bad mistakes made by our government, the U.S. right now is in what I call multi-system dysfunction. And it's roughly the equivalent of a person who is suffering from 12, 15, 20 different afflictions. And you're a doctor, you're going to try to, quote, heal this person. Where do you begin? Right? And that's how you die. You don't die from a single thing. You ultimately die from multi-system dysfunction. And that's what we have now. And so it's really tough. It is a major mess. We've allowed too many things to go on too long. And so it's like, what do you do? I have said this many times, and I will say it again, and then I'll turn pass the mic. When you're faced with a situation like this, you need something profound, something that is capable of breaking through that whole array of dysfunctions and getting to you suddenly to a place quickly where you can possibly have, you're in a new paradigm where you now have tools to deal with those things that you didn't have before. And there is only one candidate that even remotely fits that bill. And that is the paradigm shift that occurs when the world governments finally acknowledge the ET presence and the disclosure event takes place. I believe in the post-disclosure world, for the first time in a very long time, all things become possible again, and we will see the greatest age of reform ever in the human history, and we may actually make progress across the board in all these things.
The question was about Bitcoin. Is anybody going to address Bitcoin?
It was about Bitcoin?
I'll say something about it. Bitcoin is based on the principle on which the American dollar was based, that it was tied into a substance, gold, that was it. Bitcoin has a basic value that is assigned and then divided among the bitcoins. And it's a real thing that stands for another real thing. What we have is a dollar that stands for air. And that is being undermined and undermined. I'd like to talk about the trap of the derivatives. People don't understand what derivatives were. Derivatives was the collection of all your debt and amassing it into a tranche. And this debt, future profit, was bought and traded by the banks for real money. For every dollar in a tranche, the banks could borrow $1 to $10 of effective real cash. They took that money and through MTNs, monetary treasury notes, they would transfer them electronically overnight, lend them to Asia, and collect 1.5% for the use of it, and it went back and forth and back and forth. So they learned how to make more profit on your debt than your success. Banks used to work symbiotically with us to help us succeed. We succeeded, the bank succeeded. But these diabolical mathematical geniuses figured out how to make more money by your debt. And I say, what they did is they bought and sold the hole in your pocket. And Bitcoin is an attempt to correct that. And the government always comes down on any attempt to create an alternate currency. So that's where we stand, folks.
Hey, my name is James. First, I want to say that you guys are like heroes to me. You guys are rock stars and celebrities to me. And Mr. Bassett, I wanted to ask you about the citizens' hearing on disclosure. If you could kind of update us, if those politicians that you all gave testimony to are in any way advocating for disclosure currently. And then also, as my generation comes into more and more positions of power and influence, how would you all suggest that we help this movement?
Okay, very, very briefly. The citizen hearing on disclosure was a huge success. It was filmed. It was webcast. The plan was to then move to the Congress. You know what God thinks about people who make plans, right? That didn't happen. The last year has been very tough. A lot of bad things happen. And so I didn't get to the Congress when I wanted to. On the other hand, over the last year, Congress has gone through what I consider a complete meltdown and is now pretty much approaching what I would call, I don't know, schizophrenia, and it's going to get even worse through the election. And so what's happened is that the Congressional Hearing Initiative, in which the full copy, oh, I have it over there, I'll try to get it, a full copy of the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, big DVD set, very nice. It's going to be delivered to all members, all the House and Senate offices, as well as certain key people in the White House, and blah, 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 accompanied by a huge media blitz, and an email blitz, and a tweet blitz, which we're going to be asking all of the millennials to participate in hugely, will launch right after the election. Right? When we think, hope, things will have calmed down. Of course, by then, ISIS will be pretty much ruling three of the major nations in the Middle East. But it'll be a fait accompli at that point, and there'll be nothing they can do about it. And so we will launch it in November. I'm going to spend at least 2 to 3 months in Washington. Already have a place to stay, given by a supporter. Still trying to raise some bucks. Like to get about another $40,000 to drive this baby home. And I hope to have a commitment to have hearings and maybe even a hearing set up by late January of next year. That's where things are. If we get the hearings, we have several hundred witnesses ready to go to the Hill tomorrow. This is one right here. And once the media sees men like him and many others testifying under oath before Congress on this subject, that's it, folks, because I know what the media will do. It will be a massive frenzy, and we will get disclosure.
Next question.
Thank you, gentlemen. Don, this is to anyone, really to everyone. But regarding disclosure, it does sound very amazing. But surely the intelligence agencies and the diabolical people in them have thought of this way before any of us were talking about it. And therefore they must be anticipating this. And so even if we compel people to disclose everything, how are we to know as good people that the government is not going to use deception, which is its best tool, and fake it or do a number of things like Carol Rosen has spoken about and others, that there's a plan already in the works in any number of ways to deceive the public. I'm sure you're all aware of that, but sure. That's what I worry about with regards to disclosure.
So you're forgive me.
My question is, you know.
Yeah, okay. Look, I am sure somebody in the Pentagon or the CIA raised their hand 30, 40 years ago and said, you know, when we finally announce the ET presence, there's a great opportunity there. I think we can really work that one in our favor 30 years ago. But no, this is 2014. And here's what's going to happen. If disclosure takes place, and they have made the very, very unwise decision to play a game, right? Disinfo after that in order to, quote, manipulate us. 10 million internet bloggers are going to descend on them like wasps. The media, of course, is going to jump to our side a moment disclosure takes place because it validates everything, and the media ultimately, once they're freed up, are in the business of making money, getting ratings, and Pulitzer Prizes. And so it's the media and us against the government. And we're going to take apart every word that they put out on this subject, and we're going to take it down to the molecules. And if they even try to distort that truth, we are going to slice them up like a Benihana shrimp dinner. And so it ain't going to work. That's my answer. It can't happen. It's another time. So that ship has sailed. Now I'm going to get zapped by lightning.
First, I'd like to thank each and every speaker for bringing your information to us. I think it's very important thing to have, especially at this time of development. For everyone, for myself, and for my family, and everybody, humanity. Thank you for humanity. okay, my question is very simple and short. There's a gentleman, Iranian U.S. Nuclear physicist, I think. His name is Imran Kesh. I don't know if you've heard of this gentleman.
Kesh.
Yes, with the Kesh Foundation, I think it is. And he's brought forward some information about his type of UFO, his technology, you have gravity, and so on and so forth. I just like to know if you know about this and what your thoughts are.
Yes, I have read some of his papers. I have looked at his work. I know that for a while, at least after his initial announcement, that I believe it was the Iranian government came in and suppressed a lot of what he was talking about, and he had to move elsewhere in order to move forward with what he was doing. Surprisingly, the country France seems to be very happy to bring people like Pons and Fleischmann and other individuals into their borders and develop some of these kinds of technologies, which I think is very refreshing. One of the interesting things that Keshi had mentioned was that he was finding evidence that, believe it or not, plasmas actually seem to have a kind of sentience, that they seem to be controllable by your thoughts, that you can actually manipulate plasma by thinking or willing it to do a certain thing. So it really raises an interesting question whether or not a lot of people all thinking positive things about plasma couldn't bring about some really magnificent changes just by asking for some help. But anyway, I hope I answered the question.
I think Joseph.
All right. Let me just add a little anecdote. I don't know anything about Mr. Keshi's research, but what Mark said about plasmas. There was a famous quantum physicist back in the 50s and 60s by the name of David Bohm, and his specialty was plasmas. He wrote a version of quantum mechanics, not terribly popular now, but it was respected back in the day, and he also wrote a wonderful book, Wholeness and the Implicate Order, but Bohm said very much the same thing that Mark said about Keshi. He said that plasmas appear to have some sort of sentient properties to them, so that's very interesting.
All right, next one.
Hey, how are you doing? So, I have a question, Mark, somebody for Mr. McCallum's sharing. I'm curious, so your generation, being an aerospace engineer in the 60s must have been an exciting time. And nowadays, I feel that there is that same excitement. And, in the 60s, you guys did everything on draft boards, and today we have AutoCAD. But just in your opinion, do you think we've lost anything in this current generation that your generation had? And what's it going to take for us to actually get it back to the moon?
That's a fantastic question. Is this thing on? Can you hear me? Okay, just not close enough. Yeah, fantastic question. This is one of the things that I've actually dealt with directly because with the advent of computer-generated imagery, I've seen a big drop in the number of requests for my work as an illustrator because I basically work with paintbrushes, paint, and airbrushes. Doesn't mean that the quality of the work is any less. It's just a little bit longer to produce it than you would expect with a computer. One of the things that disturbs me about computers and how they've influenced the young people in our lives is that they've taken away the social interaction that occurs between young people when they just talk to one another, when they read one another's expressions, when they look at the twinkle in somebody's eyes, when they tell a funny story. Scary moment that I witnessed personally at a sandwich shop that I eat at every day. It's three or four high school kids standing in line in front of me, and they're all busy thumbing away on their little iPhones. And the kid in front of me is busy writing something, and they hit send, and the other three kids laugh. This is a true story. That was when I knew that we were in trouble, because they had lost the ability to talk to one another face-to-face. And I think that part of what's happening with video games and interactive video type programs is that people are merely becoming reactionary. They're looking what's on the screen. They're reacting. They're using the joystick, whatever the controls may be, to affect a change, but there's no imagination involved at all. It's all reaction. In fact, one of the systems that I worked on at General Dynamics was a tank as an anti-aircraft gun system called the DIVAD tank, Divisional Air Defense. It was a gun system on a turret. But we had Activision come in and design the controls so that the kids that would be using it would know how to relate to the system. That's how bad it is. So in answer to your question, yes, I'm very worried about that. I think that we need to focus on bringing imagination back into the school system, having kids try to conceptualize things that they've never seen or thought of before so that we can bring that back, because I think it's essential to our growth as a civilization.
Very briefly, the millennial generation, which was born since 1985, in many ways is the most extraordinary generation we've ever seen. They have enormous abilities, but one of the problems is that they are very savvy. And they've already figured out the degree of corruption, They've also figured out all of this dysfunction, and a lot of them are basically turned off by it. And so to ignite the millennials to really get into this, we've got to see some truth. The Congress has got to redeem itself by getting in the truth business. The president needs to redeem himself by backing away from some of the manipulation he's under and so forth. When they see that, I think they're going to get very excited. But right now, they're sort of blanketed by, you know, the situation at hand, which I don't blame them for going, what the, you know, and like, you know, just partying a little bit. But there's still a chance to do that.
The same gentleman found Polo on the internet, and you, I think you're the best person to answer this.
Sorry, guys. Okay, so real quick, I was just Googling after listening to your guys' podcast. I found this image online from Google, just a Google stock image. And I found it interesting for a couple reasons. Three light sources at the top, you can see lens flare.
Yep.
I don't know if you mentioned the moon or not, I'm skeptical, but Mr. Morningstar, I'd just like your opinion, and I'll take my answer on the floor. Thank you.
I believe that they are lens flares.
I looked at that before, and I've seen photographs that, like that in the magazines. I do believe that there are lens flares happening, and I don't take it to be a faked photograph. What I would like to do is get the photo in my computer and run the process that I brought out the crater rim, and that would be the way to tell. But I've seen a lot of lens flares, and they seem kind of typical to the things that I've seen in other photographs that are sometimes mistaken for UFOs. It's a very, very dicey affair. You can be taken in by the reflection of the sunlight from the bevel in your camera can hit the lens and refract. And so I wouldn't say that this is a fake photograph off the shot, right off the bat. I would have to study it more deeply.
I'd like to comment also, if it's all right. One of the things you'll notice if you study the photograph closely is that you can see that there are multiple crosshairs in different places, and that in some spots, like right above the lunar module, you can see a pair of crosshairs, which means, and look at the border along the top, this is actually three separate images that have been merged somehow. And so you get artifacts when that kind of a process occurs in the development, bringing the image together of three different camera shots. You get different perspectives. You also get different kinds of lighting effects. And so very often people see pictures of the moon and they see a blurry spot where there's this overlap between the data, the digital information that has come from the original source, and you wind up saying, geez, you know, that looks like a skyscraper that somebody tried to hide, you know. Well,
we still have 10 minutes left. Question, 1 minute answer.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'd like to read out your thoughts. Thank you. John, I can understand why a corrupt elite, they want to keep the lid on. Why would ETs go along with it? Why wouldn't they simply say, we're tired of you messing with your colleagues and me, and we're going to be very good on you guys.
In my alley, guys.
I'm asked that question all the time. 1 minute, less than 1 minute, here it is. The ETs aren't going along with it. The ETs have been conducting their affairs in such a way as to drive the disclosure process for decades. Right? Every year they go back to England, plop some more crop circles down in the fields, even though they know there's thousands of people there with goggles and ultralight airplanes and everything else. What they won't do is what we call a force majeure event. In other words, under their protocol, whatever it is, they're not going to land on the White House lawn and blow this thing up and destroy the social contract of 200 nations. But they are driving us towards self-disclosure. Done properly, that gives us a couple of years to absorb it and deal with it and study it and watch thousands of documentaries. Then open contact, I think, will take place. So they do not oppose disclosure. They just want it to be human disclosure first and then ET contact.
I have a personal experience that I'd like to share that I think is extremely relevant.
You only got 1 minute.
But other people have spoken longer.
That
really
is true.
I know the NASA phone number for us. I really need to say this.
Yeah, but we have to leave here.
No, I wanted to say this. Okay. I know the NASA portfolio, the space portfolio, and the radio broadcasts. And I can tell you from personal experience, I know time is short, come up and see me, I'll be here tomorrow too, if you'd like to know more. But the bottom line is, I was personally in the meeting when the top people and Jess Moore, who was head of the show program and head of Goddard, they came into the chief domestic policy advisor, who was my mentor, Dr. Mark Anderson, in the White House, and they asked for lots of money for their space program. And Dr. Anderson, in my presence, and I kept the official record, said, you're not going to get any money from the Reagan administration. You're not going to get, you're going to get $0 from the Reagan administration. So we heard here that the black budget for high technology tripled during the 8 years of the Reagan administration. But I'm here to tell you, at least in the first 2 years, I was in the West Virginia White House, I was in the Oval Office, holding the space and NASA portfolio, it was not from the White House. So where was it from? And I can tell you from personal experience, it was because of Edward Teller.
Teller?
All right, next one.
Thank you. I'll make it real short and real sweet, but I wanted your opinion on my thoughts. And my thoughts is that it's all our fault that we let this get out of hand and we haven't put a stop to the curriculum to us long ago. When they stopped teaching the Constitution in the school system, that should have been a clue. When they tell you you got to pay so much money for a medical plan and so much copay and all that, and they don't teach medicine in school. You go to school, you learn English, you learn how to pay the voucher books and pay your taxes. Why don't they teach a little medicine in school? What age, your temperature, what could go wrong, infections, illnesses, and teach that in school. So by the time you turn high school age and out of school, you can be in
the Look, you've raised an important point, and I do try to mention this in my presentations. The American people have to take a significant measure of responsibility for where we are right now. All right? We had a lot of votes and a lot of elections. We've had a lot of opportunities to affect this. We have not done the job. Now, on the other hand, one of the great problems of the rise of a secret empire is that when you absorb so much behind a secrecy curtain, you essentially diminish dramatically the ability of the citizenry to address the problems through the usual processes, because how do you address a problem you don't even know you have? And so secrecy is poison to a democratic process. But there has been plenty of opportunity for American people to step in. They haven't done it, and so they got to step up and own some of that.
I would like to say one thing. Ed, you can be crazy and you can be right. Okay?
Okay.
I can be crazy and I can be right.
All I can say is I'm being pushed over here to stop now.
You're not being pushed. Where?
You're wasting my time. I'm trying to hurry for you, okay? Listen, all the people need to get together and start thinking right and start doing what you want and take your country back.
Right.
All right, next one.
I believe the culture there has been sufficiently protected to remain the victors of World War II in a 10th Mountain Division style, if you're familiar. Will the speakers consider integrating with that potential to educate the citizens of the legacy deserved from being that type of victor of World War II, so that we can edifice or enlighten the citizens of how to embrace that type of victory? Because it's not commonly known. Most people don't wake up and become Joseph P. Farrell or Robert Morningstar. Are you willing to dedicate any education to the local culture? Because I still believe we are protected and value releasing what needs to be done in a proper manner for the entire global culture. And what's
any quick comments?
Yes, as far as education is concerned, that's the most important thing. We're educating as many people as we can, and it is my hope that you will go out and educate your friends, because when you isolate the knowledge in yourself, it just will rely with you and will not spread. It's my hope that you will take this debate And don't be afraid of debating. Don't be afraid of raising your voice, standing up for what you believe. I feel the millennial generation is too docile. You've been taught to be too courteous, never raise your voice, never get angry. Look, sometimes anger works. I don't advise it all the time, but when, like I said this morning, I'm an eagle, not a beagle. Don't treat me like a dog, right? Or I will bark and bite back. So you have to get a little, men, you have to get a little more manly. Women, you have to get a little more womanly. In the old way that we were, we've all lost a lot because we've become too docile. We've become afraid to speak our opinions, right or wrong. Speak your opinion, defend it, debate it. If you're right, you will be accepted. If you're wrong, you will be corrected, and you will be better for having been corrected.
All right. Two quick more questions here. We can squeeze it in.
Thank you. Mr. McCann's geoengineering chemtrails thesis is chapter and verse equal to Mr. Whittington's on our moderator's Red Eye's website radio program, which I only just heard just last night. A pat on the back to Mr. Palmgren. The question is for Mr. Palmgren. Would you be kind enough to reach out to and try to make contact with Guy McPherson, who will have some observations on this issue? It's a dose of castor oil. No one's going to want to hear it, but I believe it fits in with Mr. Whittington, his neighbor's thesis and this lady's thesis. It's about runaway greenhouse effect, and I think we all should hear. Would you please be kind enough to try to make contact with Guy McPherson? Just Google Nature Bats Last. Very great job, Mr. Palmer.
Thank you. I'll promise to Google it, okay? Thanks.
I think it was shown definitively this morning that some of the stuff is seen in the sky, which is stuff that we man-engineer. It's a hypothesis that we reverse engineer and that there are ETs alive. But perhaps we should go back to the disclosure news conference, and where a gentleman said that they've identified 50 different ETs. And I would suggest, gentlemen, that some of them are not benevolent, and that may be one of the reasons they're not disclosure.
Yeah, Cliff Stone did say that. It's not known how many species are dealing with us, but we do have over 1 million contact reports that have been submitted to researchers, 500,000 to Whitley Strieber. So we have a pretty good idea of the 4, 5, 6 primary groups. And there may be some others that have come and gone. And from that contact reports, accounts that have been submitted, we have a pretty good idea of their general behavior. And some of the behavior is definitely suspect. Some of it clearly violates some of our fundamental, some of our moral code. But overall, when you look at the sum and total of their activity as best presented by the contactee reports, and not getting into the fringe theories that bubble up, and that's going to happen, their actions are not evil. They are occasionally upsetting, and there is some point for concern, and I think we will learn some unsettling things post-disclosure, but I believe that the evidence is that the fundamental program will be positive, and we will be relatively comfortable with the truth once it comes out post-disclosure. But that's not a certainty. But the overall basic evidence points there, and the assertions about really awful stuff with respect to ETs comes from an evidentiary base that's much smaller. But because it talks about terrible things, you can't avoid it because it's possible. But body parts and vats of humans and all this other stuff, the evidence just isn't there. And you can make a very strong philosophical argument for why evil ETs doesn't make any sense. But I'm just saying, I've been at it for 18 years, I've seen and heard a lot, I am not uncomfortable about the truth that I expect to learn post-disclosure.
Mark, quick.
I want to comment briefly on his comment about geoengineering and how it relates to ETs. Because we see so much of this kind of activity, and I'm talking about both unusual craft in the skies and chemtrailing, it's become apparent to me that the chemtrailing is very much like the chaff that they used to put into the air to defeat
the tracking systems of radar because it's very reflective. It's reflective of a couple things. It's reflective of radar, but it's also reflective of light, especially if you've got a set of night vision goggles like Ed Grimsley. And so one of the best ways to obscure flight operations of a very exotic form of propulsion is to basically blanket the area prior to flight operations with chemtrails. Now, Dane Wigington is a friend of mine, and I've asked him to take a look at this sincerely. And he's still sort of up in the air as far as his answer, but I can tell you personally that where I have made my observations, I've been at a location that's further east of the metropolitan Reading area when the chemtrails came in off the ocean, and I've seen flight operations above the chemtrails that could not be seen from the city limits, but beyond those, when you're much further out, you can see the activity occurring. And so I know there's a connection. I've seen it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think we need to begin to wrap up for this time. So give the gentleman a round of applause, everybody. Thank you. All right. We need to wrap up here for now then. And I hope we see everybody tomorrow, obviously, at 8:45 for another day. Excellent stuff ahead. So I hope you join us tomorrow. Thank you, everybody.
I am.